Hi, everybody. Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. And of course, it is the holiday of Chanukah. And we talk about Chanukah in many different ways. And the candle that stays lit, for the oil that goes for 8 days, and the military battle and the few against the many. But as all of you know, I'm a culinary Zionist. And so I wanted to do a show today on the olive oil itself. And I was connected with Ehud Soriano, who is one of the experts in Israel on olive oil. And he joins me this morning. Thank you so much, Ehud, for taking your time.
Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. So tell my audience a little bit about you. You're a young guy. What makes you one of Israel's experts on olive oil?
Well, 10 years ago, I started my my expedition in the olive oil in the olive oil sector. Since I remember myself, I consider myself as a farmer. Like I grew in a kibbutz. I'm in the Jordan Valley, and since I was young, I was working in the fields. And then when I grew up after the army, I figured that there are two sectors that I'm not familiar with yet with agriculture. One of them was olive trees and then olive oil. So I went to the Golan Heights to work in an olive orchard and actually with vines too, with the grapes for wine. And from that point, it was, I don't know, just I went with the flow, but the flow was really, the current was really known for me already. Like, I knew that, I figured out that I like it a lot, and I find it very interesting, and I just got more and more into it. The place where I used to work, they decided to build an olive mill, and I was among the ones who started the whole thing with the olive mill there. I ran the olive mill. Then I moved, shifting to the marketing and sales, and of the olive oil brand, the company sold. Throughout this time, I was getting more and more into the olive oil quality issue, because it's something that it's a kind of a mystery it's a vague thing. Everybody knows it's important, but most producers and most people don't really know what it means and what makes olive oil better or worse, or defected or not defected. And so I went to some courses, some professional courses here in Israel. Then after I finished my job in the Golan Heights, I went to Spain to accomplish a little bit of work and studying there about olive oil quality. Then I came back to Israel, and I started to consult producers about olive oil quality. I found that the Israeli, refounding the Israeli tasting oil, like the Israeli panel of the olive oil tasting. And also I'm lecturing and teaching about olive oil quality in universities here in Israel and abroad also.
Okay, so I grew up in California. So, I mean, you know, wine obviously has been big for a long time. But oil, nobody really discussed oil. There was this oil, there was that oil. I moved here to Israel close to 30 years ago, and I discovered olive oil, this Mediterranean, it has to be olive oil. But it seems like it's really only in the last maybe decade or 15 years, right in perfect timing for you, that there has been somewhat of a resurgence of, I would say, an olive oil culture even, where people are, to some degree, even olive oil snobs. Like, you'll go to a restaurant, and which kind of olive oil do you want with which particular dish? Some of the fancier restaurants will even charge for olive oil. Like, who heard of that? So there seems to be this like you said, a resurgence of this idea that olive oil is a fine food. It's not just something, you know, that's out there, one of the ingredients that you would put in food. There's actually some kind of culture. So like when we look back, let's say at the Hanukkah story, which has a lot to do with olive oil, it seems here, at least in the land of Israel, this was one of the commodities that they had. And if you could please talk a little bit about the archaeology, how do we know that we've been doing olive oil here for a very long time? And even if we look like in the Bible, the first tree that's mentioned by name is the olive tree, the little, right, the dove that goes and brings back the branch after the flood. So clearly this is a food, and that's in this part of the world. Clearly this is a food that is known for a very, very long time, one of the earliest foods that mankind has. Can you go a little bit into the history?
The history of the olive tree around the Mediterranean, and especially in archaeologists and historians call the Levant, which right. is basically Israel, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon. the history is a very, very long and going back history for, well, olive tree is, I don't know if the first olive tree to, the first fruit tree to be domesticated, but among the first one for sure. Mm-hmm. It's one of the oldest, with no doubt, going back to 6,000, at least 6,000 years BC. Okay, so we're talking about 8,000 years ago from now. Mm-hmm. If we're taking into mind that the agriculture revolution started around 10,000 years ago, or 8,000 years ago, we're talking about only a very short time before people started going from field crops into fruit trees, which are much more difficult to domesticate. Okay, so for example, wheat is much easier to domesticate than a fruit tree. Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't know if a lot of people know, but apples and almonds, for example, were domesticated only in the last 700 years, something like that.
Wow.
Okay. So, okay. Yeah, it takes a lot of time to domesticate a fruit tree, and olive oil and olive trees were among the first one. Then it was a key food product in every culture around the Mediterranean. In ancient times, it was sometimes better than money. Like people didn't appreciate money as they appreciate olive oil, because olive oil is something you can do something with, mm-hmm. and everybody will appreciate it around the Mediterranean. If you go with a nickel of something, I don't know, to Egypt, nobody knows it, like where it comes from. It's right. it's from a king in Canaan. Nobody knows
or
the
cares.
King, and nobody,
right.
yeah, it, the currency is nothing. But if you go with olive oil, which is very easy to transfer from one point to another, and it keeps its quality when it's well preserved. Everybody appreciates it. Everybody knows what it means to have an olive oil with you, and mm-hmm. and so it was something that spread really, really fast throughout the Middle East and the Mediterranean. Then. The Phoenicians,
mm-hmm.
today's
Lebanon, the Phoenicians,
yeah,
into northern
Phoenicians,
part of Israel,
yeah.
too.
They actually took it to the north of Africa, to Libya, to Tunisia.
Really?
Nowadays Tunisia and Libya, yeah. They took it to Spain. They introduced the olive oil, the olive tree, to Spain. Maybe even Portugal. Nobody really knows, but they mm-hmm. they assume that Portugal too. And again, the Greeks and then the Etruscans in Italy. So basically, it started here and it went through the Mediterranean. Actually, the interesting thing about the olive tree in Israel is that the most ancient evidence we have for olive oil olive oil use. Usage and olive tree domestication is in Israel. It's actually
really?
In Israel, in the lower Galilee near Tzipori. And in the Carmel Mount, actually, it's not in the Carmel Mount. It's in front of the Carmel in the sea.
Right.
In the Mediterranean, Mediterranean Sea. But at that, when we're talking about 40,000 years ago, the sea level was lower. So
right.
There were settlements where now it's water.
Right.
They found there piles, big piles of olive pits. They're not assumed to be used for olive oil. Like they don't. Archaeologists don't think they know. Don't think that those people knew how to make olive oil, but they were surely and certainly used the olives.
They were eating them. Hmm.
Yeah. For I don't know what purpose.
You know, if you already mentioned the Phoenicians, I learned recently, I don't know if this is true, that it's actually Hebrew messed something up, that the olive that we call Suri, which would mean Syrian olive today, was really Tsor, which is the Hebrew word for Tyre, T-Y-R-E, which is in today's Lebanon, but was a Phoenician city. And in Hebrew, because it sounds so familiar, Tsori and Suri, it actually got changed to what people would now call Syrian olive, but really is Lebanese, is Phoenician? Is that true? Did the Hebrew, yeah, that is?
Yeah, oh, cool. It is true, yeah. The Syrian, the Suria variety of, that is spread all around Israel.
Right.
And Lebanon is actually a Tsori, yeah, it's from Tsor.
Okay, cool.
Okay, not from Syria.
Right. It shows the Hebrew involvement in the olive world already. Then, long enough to mess it
yeah,
up.
Yeah, they changed the tzaddik and the samer, like
right.
the two the pronunciation was
right.
a bit different between different people. Then it changed. But it's not sorry. Anyway, in the Lower Galilee. In the ancient city of Sapporia in Sapporo, they found big amphoras with olive oil inside, with the olive oil remains. It's not really olive oil, but they found a kind of oily remain, and they examined it in laboratories, and they found it's olive oil. And this is the most ancient evidence we have of olive oil usage, which is amazing because it takes us back to 6,000 years BC.
So you said that you worked on the Golan Heights. Now,
yeah.
So I know, like also from my tour guiding life, that we've got some very old, what they call batei bad, or the olive presses. The bad in Hebrew being the beam, because you need a lot of power, you need a lot of strength and a lot
of
pressure
kind of
to crush the olives and get the olive oil, hence the name. That there's a big concentration of old batei bad, of old olive presses in the Golan Heights, but only in certain areas. What was exactly going on up there, and when?
It's amazing with ancient people in ancient times. They didn't really knew why things work, but they knew they work or not, and they knew how to adjust themselves and to adjust the way they live in order to succeed in a certain areas. And in the Golan Heights, it's very interesting. The west of the center area of the Golan Heights, we're talking about, I don't know if people are or aware of the map, but it's around Katsarin and Yaudia area. It's the middle, it's the center of the Golan Heights, but in the west side of it, like more closer to the Sea of Galilee, to the Kinneret. Okay?
Right.
This area is very rocky. Okay. There's not a lot of soil you can put trees or any other crops on it because it's a very, very rocky area. On the other hand, in the east of this area, of the center of the Golan Heights, going a bit to the border with Syria. It's there's a much lesser rocks, like lesser rocks.
Right.
Okay. And there's a lot of soil, very heavy soil. Okay. And another thing is that in this area, in the east of the Golan Heights, the land goes in stairs. Okay. So it's kind of like this and this.
Right.
Okay.
Like steps.
It's not.
Right.
Like steps. Okay.
Yeah.
It's not a downhill.
Right, it's not a plateau like in other parts, or sloped, right?
Yeah, it's not a slope, exactly. Anyway, because of that reason, because of these steps, water are standing in the ground. They're not flowing anywhere. Mm-hmm. Okay, they're just in the ground. They stay in the ground. And in the other end, in the west of the Golan Heights, they just flow. So in the west of the Golan Heights, in the west of the center of the Golan Heights, we have a rocky area with not a lot of soil, and the water do not stays in the ground.
Right, it drains down into the Kinneret. Yes.
It drains, yeah, and this is the perfect ambient for olive oil growing, because olive trees do not need heavy soil. They don't like water stains around the tree. Okay, they don't like it to live in a swamp,
right?
Kind of
date palms during the winter. They like sitting in water.
Yeah, and right. Exactly, and they can go pretty good with very few soil around the roots.
Uh huh.
So this is where we found the most of the olive mills in the Golan Heights. We have few in the south of the Golan Heights. We have only one or two in the north of the Golan Heights near the Mount Hermon. Okay, only one or two, but we have dozens in the center of the Golan Heights.
Uh-huh.
Because it was an area very good, very adjust for olive trees growing. And in the east, we find vines, we find grapes for wine, because they can go along very good with water that stays in the ground. They can go very good. They can work with heavy soils,
mm-hmm.
okay? And they don't mind the water that surrounds them around the winter, because they go to sleep. They kind of hibernate.
Right.
And
it's good and soil
so
for grapes,
east,
right?
It was,
it's volcanic
yeah,
rock,
so, in the
so
east
it's perfect.
We have,
right.
We have presses for wine, and in the west we have olive presses for olive oil, and the dozens of olive mills we found, the olive presses are much more than the community in this area needed to have,
mm-hmm.
and what archaeologists think today is that there was a very developed
the trade in
connection.
Olive oil?
Yeah, the trade, mm-hmm. yeah, between the east of the empire, the Persian Empire, the Roman Empire, the Assyrian Empire, and Canaan and the Phoenicians, because of this, dozens of olive mills they found.
So they
in
must
a
have, it
place.
Must have been a commodity if they were growing
yeah,
that
yeah,
much
yeah,
more
exactly.
than they needed
was,
for their salad and soap.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it was. It's something in a commodity level. It was a center of olive oil making in Israel, in ancient Israel.
So there's an archaeological site that some of my listeners might be familiar with called Gamla. It was a Jewish town that we know was destroyed in the year 67 as part of the Great Revolt. And part of the reason that they say, it's interesting that you mentioned the Persians, that the Romans came after Gamla, which is like all the way at the edges there on the Golan Heights. Like, why bother? And we know that there was a lot of olive oil production there because we have found the olive presses there as near also ritual baths, mikvaot. So there's a theory that maybe they used it for the temple even because, you know, they had to be pure. But the one of the reasons the Romans came after them there is because there were horsemen there. There were Jewish horsemen there who used to belong to the Parthian army, the Persian army in the east. And they were worried that maybe these guys would then attack the Romans from the back, and therefore they wanted to get rid of Gamla. So it's, you know, there's the olive oil, there's the commodity that they used in order to make a living, because just like today, you have to make a living. I mean, Ehud, you make a living in olive oil, which is actually a very, you know, before I guess Jews were doctors and lawyers and high-tech people, we were making, you know, our living in olive oil. So you're actually doing something that's very ancient. But also,
exactly.
There's a lot of the history and the military and who controlled this and the politics and the Assyrians also. And we talk about the Greeks, you know, Hanukkah is about the Greeks coming from Antioch, from, you know, the northern part of today of Turkey and Syria and coming down. So all of this, like, you know, there's a whole world here that, you know, existed there, and we can try and piece it together from some of the archaeology. And even something like finding a concentration of olive presses in an area can tell us a lot about the people who lived there and what they were doing there at the time. So there's another archaeological site called Kribet Kaifa that I was just at last month for a review. It's in the Ella Valley. It's way down between south of Jerusalem, where the border of Philistine and Judea was, where they say David fought Goliath. And one of the things that they're using now to date the site and the people's presence at the site are some olive seeds, olive pits that were found there. So do you ever get a call from like an archaeologist, or do you ever work, you know, to see like what also what kind of olives would have been, which is something, another subject I wanted to ask you. I'm going all over the place here. Because just like wine has so many different strains, are there just a few strains of olives that have held down through history, or has that also changed through time? So I just threw a whole bunch of questions at you. I apologize. I know you can handle it, though.
It's okay. So let's begin. First of all, if we go back to the Romans and the story with Gamla, it's the Romans are well known for taking advantage of all kind of excuses, okay, to take over places in order to control the trade
and the economics and the
of this area.
Right.
It's well known with the Nabateans.
Nabateans and the spice trade, which Nabateans, the Romans eventually
take
over too.
So this is the most known example, but there are a lot more examples of this fact. And going to Kribet Kaifa, olive pits are, first of all, they are local. So if you find an olive pit, you can say, okay, we had a settlement here for sure. Okay, it wasn't just you won't find olive pits in, for example, in fortresses of an army. Okay, it's not likely because they already got the product, the olive oil. Mm-hmm. Okay, they don't need to grow their own.
Right.
Yeah. But if you do find pits of olive oil, of olive tree, you can say for sure we had a settlement, a civilian settlement in this area. This is the first thing, and the second, it's very good for dating the time of the settlement. And the third, I don't know if they checked the genetics of those pits and realized which variety they belong to, but there was a very interesting work that had been done in the Faculty of Israel around ancient Syria olive trees in Israel, and not only in Israel, in Jordan, also in the Palestinian Authority, in Lebanon. And what they found is that all of the Suries in the Levant are the same Suries, which
really
is amazing because it was long considered that we have all different kind of clones and different types of the same thing. Well, everything is the same genetically. Everything is the same variety. Okay, then we have all kind of mixture between grafting olive trees, because in the ancient times it was the only way to bring olive trees to a new place. You took the pit, you germinated it, mm-hmm. then you graft the olive tree, you were like the fruit you wanted on it.
Mm-hmm.
So the grafting are the same everywhere. The clones, it's the base plant of the tree.
Right.
Okay, is different. In every area, in every even smaller areas, it differs from village to village. But the fruit itself is the same fruit.
Wow.
Which is amazing, really, yeah.
That's really interesting. Is it true that there's no such thing as black olive trees, that everything starts off green and the longer you leave it on the tree, then it turns blacker? But it's not like apples. You have red apples and yellow apples. You don't have green olives and black olives. It all comes from the same tree? Yeah.
Exactly. We have few very like one or two varieties that actually don't turn black, they turn white. It
Ooh.
is yeah, it's something. There are two, one an Italian variety, the second one is a Spanian variety, the Spanish variety. But the rest of them are stunning green and turn into black. No, there's not even one olive fruit in the world that starts black. All of them starts green.
Do you have an explanation for why the tree lives so long? I mean, you can go around and you can see olive trees that are hundreds of years old. Is it the tree that lives the longest? And is there an explanation why? Because it is such an ancient tree and it has adapted so well to the environment over time? Do they know why this tree is just has so much longevity?
I don't know for sure, but I have some. I can come up with some explanations. I think that the tradition around the tree is what kept him so vivid around this area of the Mediterranean and the Middle East for so long without cutting it down for fire or I don't know any other usage, because it's got more and more. Holy in the last decade and not decades even like then and it's considered to be a holy tree since ancient times.
So it
One
was
of the
left
things
alone.
is that you can use yeah because it was you can use everything in the tree. You can use the oil, you can use the peat, you can use the leaves, you can use the branches. It's a functional tree in ancient times, and it's a functional fruit product, the olive oil. Even today, it's like it has a kind of a liberation with all the health movements since the beginning of the 90s. So things that are so functional in the lives of people. Are staying longer, I guess, and this is why it kept so much, and other trees maybe had less importance because they're not that important. But olive tree is really, really important to everything, to the economics, to the life of people here, to the wealth of people, okay, with trade and stuff, and so it, I guess this is the reason
They
it
should.
stays with us till now.
So there's this, I mean, there's a story that I heard about the olive tree. Obviously, it's a let's a you know an allegorical story because the olive tree hollows out in the middle. In order to say how old an olive tree is, you can't count its rings. It actually gets hollow in the middle, and sometimes even looks like a few different trees if it's really old. So there's a story which you may be familiar with that when King Solomon died, all of nature went into mourning. I guess he could also speak the language of nature, except for the olive tree. The olive tree didn't cry. So Mother Nature puts the olive tree on trial afterwards and says, "What happened? Why didn't you cry? This great king dies." And the olive tree says, "I cried on the inside." And so Mother Nature punishes the olive tree for not showing its emotion with three things. One is that to be harvested, you will be beaten. And still today, if you go into some like traditional villages, you see the blanket goes around the tree at harvest time, and the people literally smack the tree in order for the fruit to come down or shake the tree. The other one is that you will die from the inside out. And the third punishment is that you will live for a long time so that everything you love will die before you and you're going to be in a constant state of mourning. So I think, like you
That's
said here,
a beautiful story.
right?
I didn't, I wasn't aware of it, but it's a beautiful
Oh,
story.
really? I got to teach the
Yeah.
olive expert something. So, but I think it just shows how, as you said, there's a holiness to the tree. There's something about the tree that's more than just the fruit and the oil. There's like an image to the tree or some kind of connection to the tree as part of, the lifestyle of the people here in, as you said, the Levant in the ancient world. You mentioned the pits. So I know that in the Golan Heights, there's the guy who has the oleo factory there, and he won a clean tech award for coming up with what to do with what's left, the sludge, or I don't know what you call it, what's left after you press the oil. What is it called? The skin and the pits, the pomace. So the first time I heard this, I was really surprised that it's toxic. I would think, okay, it's this organic stuff. You could even use it for fertilizer. And then I was told that quite the opposite, that it can actually ruin the water table, that you have to dispose of the tons and tons and tons of what's left around the Mediterranean. How does that work?
It's not about being toxic or not. It's in the olive fruit, there are a lot of polyphenols. It's a compound named polyphenols. They are one of the things they do. They are acting as antioxidants. Okay, so what they basically do, they can connect free oxygen atoms,
right.
Okay, and kind of disable them from doing harm. Okay,
right,
to the olive
cancer.
Fruit.
That's a good thing, right? That's one of the reasons to drink olive oil. They say it's an antioxidant.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So in the olive oil, we have at the most 10% of the antioxidants we have in the fruit. So we only have 10% of the antioxidant inside the olive oil. And the reason is that antioxidants are hydrophils. They like water more than they like oil. So when we are extracting the olive oil from the olive paste, we lose a lot of polyphenols. And those polyphenols go with the pomace, with the leftovers of this process. And when you you spray them in the field, for example, or you taking them, you are letting them go inside the water, the drinking water we drink, they are harmful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because they are the concentration of the antioxidants is really, really, really high. And what these antioxidants do, they are interfering with oxidation, with breathing. Actually, what we are doing when we are breathing is
mm-hmm.
oxidation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, kind of in a way, in a sense. So when you're, for example, if you take this wastewater or this pomace to kind of places for treatment of any other wastewater for sewage and places like that. They work, factories work on the basis of oxidation. You take algae inside the wastewater and the sewage water of many, many areas. You just put them in one place with algae on them, and those algae are oxidating the water and purifying them in this way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? When you put wastewater of olive mills inside, they are interrupting the
uh-huh.
oxidation
it's
process.
Counterproductive.
Okay? And then
uh-huh.
yeah, and they kill the algae, so you cannot
wow.
put them in there, and you cannot put them in water in the ground, because when you are taking the water from the ground,
right.
they are polluted with high concentration of antioxidants, which might be harmful.
So this needs to be disposed of in a special way, right?
Yes.
So,
so what they do now is that they are spraying this wastewater and pomace in the fields. You are allowed to do that. It's actually when you are doing it in small quantities.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Then
it's actually okay. It's not harmful. You can do that without any risk to the
uh-huh.
ground, to the soil, to the trees around, or to the vegetation around.
And
so
I've seen some creative things too. Soap that is
the,
made. There's soaps that are made also, and even these like logs for burning in stoves, like made out of.
Yeah, there are many solutions for this. Cosmetics is a nice gimmick, I guess. It's not something that it's not that it's unimportant. It is important, and it's a beautiful solution, but it's not something that it's well so spread and everybody take the
right.
whole of their pomace and use it. Some of this pomace is used for feeding cattle and all kind of cattle. Yeah, veals and young veals and lambs. It actually has a lot of nutrition because it has a lot of, again, antioxidants, which
right.
are good, basically, and a lot of vitamins. It has some pigments that are good, very good for us. For example, a chlorophyll and a chlorophyll, and a lutein, which is another very important pigment, which is also healthy for us. So, and it has a very good, also has very good fatty acid. Okay, there is still oil in this pomace. Okay, not all the oil is extracted in the olive meal, and this few percentage of oil are in the pomace, and they are very, very healthy to the cattle. So they use it as to feed, to enrich the diet of cattle. What else?
So let me ask you some very practical
organic,
questions.
Actually, organic, also organic soil, like what's the name? I forgot the name. But organic soil also uses pomace.
So let me ask you, I've been told that a few things, and you're the expert, so I'm going to get it straight from you. One is never to buy or store olive oil in plastic, only in glass or in tin, because it somehow mixes with the plastic and it's bad for the oil. Is that true?
Yeah, it's very, very bad. If you're talking about toxicity, this is very toxic. This
really?
Is actually toxic. This is actually kill you in the long run.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not something.
You're hearing that, everybody? Never buy olive oil in plastic. I don't care how cheap it is at Costco. Okay, go spend the extra money. Glass or tin.
There is it, and I'll explain the reason. And yeah, the reason is that, well, for example, if you take water, okay, and you put alcohol, like pure alcohol, in it, the alcohol will dissolve and disappear inside the water. And the reason is that chemically wise, they are very close materials. Okay. Water and alcohol. It's the same with plastic and olive oil, because all oils are all oils are basically carbon chains. Okay, long carbon chains, man. 18 carbons, 20 carbons, 15 carbons. It doesn't matter, but carbon chains. Plastic is carbon chain, compressed and very, very long, okay? Hundreds of carbons, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually the same material.
Wow, so it dissolves into the oil?
So what happens is, like, in the plastic, in a plastic containers or bottles, you have the plastic is flexible. Okay,
right.
If you press it, it just compressed inside, and then it goes back to the shape it was.
Right.
In the beginning, and the reason is that it has a certain material that they put inside the plastic in order to make it flexible. This material, when it goes intact with olive oil or any other oil, but usually it's the most dangerous one is olive oil, because olive oil is chemically alive, okay? If you're talking about refined oil, for example, canola oil, which is very bad, sunflower oil, corn oil, any other refined oil is not chemically active. Okay? So, and olive oil it is, because olive oil is made in a cold press. So when you're putting olive oil inside plastic, they kind of talk, okay? And there is a migration of this material that keep the plastic flexible, okay?
Yeah.
From the plastic to the oil. Now, this material do not supposed to be in the UV, in the body of a human being, okay? And this material goes to the liver and stays in the liver. And from there, everything that we know that it's not a good idea. Yeah, it cancer and stuff like that. So for the long term, plastic, olive oil in plastic or any other oil in plastic will harm you, make damage. So please, please, please do not use olive oil that there was in plastic.
Okay, everybody, you heard that here. How about cooking with olive oil? Is it true that you should only have olive oil cold, that heating it up also damages it? Or there are certain kinds of olive oils that it's okay to cook with?
I want to go back a little bit and explain the thing. In every, I'm doing some sometimes lectures to professional people or less professional, and every time I'm talking with people, if you talk with them about wine, for example, people are very easy with the knowing that they don't know. Okay, mm-hmm. They are very they feel comfortable and relaxed about it because you don't have to know what's a Riesling or what a Cabernet Sauvignon or what is Bordeaux area. It's okay that you don't know it. And everybody are really comfortable with not knowing where a Roquefort, for example, cheese is coming from.
Right.
But everybody, and it's 100% everybody around the Mediterranean, in Israel, in China even, okay?
Yeah.
Everybody has an opinion about olive oil. Everybody. Okay? And this is, I'm not mentioning China for nothing. I had a workshop with a Chinese delegation. They've never seen olive oil. Okay, they don't know anything about olive oil. If I would put a glass of water in the middle of the table and say this is olive oil, they would believe it.
Really,
they've never seen olive oil. Okay, huh. But they already had a very strong sense of what's a good olive oil and a bad olive oil. And they've never used it. They've never seen it. Okay, but they know what's a good olive oil and bad olive oil.
That's crazy. Okay.
And it goes with the acidity level. It goes with what's a cold press. It goes with the olive oil is greener or more golden and yellowish.
Right. Or cloudy.
Which one? Yeah. Or murky or not or,
right.
or clear. It. Everybody has an opinion of which is better and which is worse.
Uh-huh.
So before we go into the cooking stuff, if we can just make things straight with that.
Please.
So we will have a common language when we talk about olive oil. First, if the oil is murky, it doesn't mean it's better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? For the most of the things you can say about it, it's newer, okay? But it's not better. The olive oil is not better when it's murky. A clear olive oil actually will last longer because the sediments or the murkiness in the oil is because of sediments that still didn't sink down,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
Once these sediments sink down, they are an organic active compound, okay, and they are ruining the oil,
mm-hmm.
okay. So we are we do not want these sediments inside our bottle.
Okay.
Though sometimes people buy it because it's authentic, it's 100% olive oil,
right?
Yeah,
right.
Stuff like that. It's bad. Mm-hmm. It's ruining your oil. You're paying decent money for a defective olive oil. Please do not buy olive oil with sediments.
Okay.
Clear olive oil is better, much better for the shelf life of olive oil. This is the first thing. And the second is the greener olive oil is not better than yellowish one or golden one.
Okay.
The hue of the olive oil doesn't mean anything about his quality. It doesn't say anything about what you're going to meet inside the bottle in sense of pungency or bitterness,
mm-hmm.
or fruitiness, okay? It doesn't say anything about it,
mm-hmm.
anything at all, okay? So from looking on the olive oil, just looking on it, you cannot say anything about its quality, nothing at all, okay?
Okay.
Another thing that people are confusing with is that they taste the olive oil and they say, okay, this is with high acidity, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not possible. You cannot taste acidity level in olive oil. In the same way, you cannot take a bite from a tomato, for example, and say, this has a lot of vitamin C in it.
Right.
You cannot say that.
Right.
Okay? This is in the same way, you cannot tell about the acidity level of olive oil just from drinking it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
An olive oil can be very with high acidity level, okay? and it will be very mild. And an olive oil can be with high acidity level and very pungent and bitter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You cannot tell from the taste on the acidity level. And furthermore, acidity level is not pH. Acidity level is about free fatty acid inside the oil. Okay? Actually, it's only from the oleic acid, but never mind. It's not pH.
Okay?
Just take it in mind that if you drink something with a 0.8 pH, you won't live much longer. Okay? You're going to dissolve everything inside your stomach. Okay?
Uh-huh.
Because 0.8 pH is a very, very, very low pH. It's a very, very strong acid.
Right.
Very strong
acid.
It's going
to burn out the insides. Okay?
Yeah, exactly, completely. So you're not. It's not about pH. It's about the percentage of the free fatty acid in the oil.
Okay.
And if we're talking about extra virgin, which is the high quality of olive oil, we're talking about the maximum of 0.8. This is a trade number. It's not. It's something that producers need. Needs to be aware of, not consumers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So if it says on the bottle or the olive can that it's extra virgin, please be sure it's extra virgin. It doesn't really matter if the oil is 0.8, 0.2, 0.3, or 0.4%
right.
of free fatty acid. It's not important.
Okay?
Completely not important.
Okay.
I'm just now kind of getting into the lecturing.
Right. I see.
But this is something that many, many people confuse with. People say, okay, this is not a very good olive oil because it's only 0.6 and we have
matters.
A 0.2.
Right.
And 0.2 is much better. No, it's not. 0.2% of free fatty acid and 0.6 of free fatty acid is the same thing for you. Will enjoy the oil in the same way. It's healthier in the same way.
Okay.
So
that means it hasn't been heated when it was cold pressed. So right.
Yeah. The most important thing people need to be aware of that they are, and it's very important in the U.S. because in the U.S. for example, because of all kind of legalization issues, you cannot find pure olive oil. Okay. And actually, in a survey they did in the U.S. in 2013, they found that many, many, many people, around 87%, I think, or 85, I don't remember the exact percentage, 87% or 85% are think that pure olive oil is better than extra virgin olive oil,
mm-hmm.
cold-pressed extra virgin olive oil. Okay, now pure olive oil is refined olive oil. Refined. Okay, refined means it has no healthy compounds or ingredient in it.
Wow.
Okay?
Okay.
Nothing. Okay? No no vitamins, no antioxidants.
Blank.
No.
Right.
Yeah, it's a
blank.
It's a blank oil.
Right.
Okay? But it's pure. And because it's pure, it says pure on the label, and everybody thinks, okay. If it's pure, it's nature, it's natural, it's not processed in any way. This is the most processed oil.
Wow.
Refined oil, the most processed oil. Actually, it's very bad for the ecology. It's very the carbon footprint is unbelievable. It's not a healthy oil to use.
Okay, so we're going for extra virgin, not pure. But back to the cooking, because that's something that I want to know. Forget my listeners; I want to know.
And this is connected next to the cooking issue and frying and heating and stuff like that. So when we're talking, let's talk about, for example, olive oil, canola, which is very well spread all around. Canola oil in Israel, in the United States, I guess it's the same thing. I don't know, sunflower oil, soybean oil, actually all the seed oils, okay? The oils that are made from seed, okay? Which is canola, corn, sunflower, soil, and many more.
Mm-hmm.
All of them has a certain profile of fatty acid, okay? The thing that makes olive oil much, much, much healthier and better than all of the rest, is that olive oil has exactly the opposite fatty acid profile. So olive oil has the fatty acid profile of what we need. Okay, it has a lot of sorry, I didn't keep my, I didn't shut down my phone. So olive oil has exactly the fatty acid profile we need. Okay, it has a lot from the things we need a lot,
right.
And it has few from the things we need few.
Okay.
Okay, in low quantities, and seed oils, as I mentioned, are exactly the opposite. They have a lot of free fatty of a fatty acid that we don't need.
Right.
And they have very few of the fatty acid we need.
Okay.
Okay. And in that sense, when we're going for heating them, olive oil is much healthier. Okay. Because first we have the fatty acids we need, and the second, because of the polyphenols, and the antioxidant, the other antioxidants, some of those, all of them are polyphenols, and vitamin E, which is a strong antioxidant as well. And they all inside the oil, they stay in the oil, and they are interrupt with very bad compounds that evolve inside the oil, any oil, as it heated. Okay? Am I clear?
Wait, so we can't, so we should heat oil, we can't heat olive oil, or we can?
Every oil that we heat
yeah.
starts to deteriorate.
Okay, in general.
Okay? In general,
okay.
And it doesn't matter which oil we're talking about. And with this deterioration, the deterioration is because of first, fatty acids are oxidized.
Right.
And the second is that materials that we, compounds that we don't want inside our body or inside the oil are evolved from, produced from this heating process. In olive oil, those compounds are barely emerged, are barely produced.
Uh-huh.
Why? Because we have many things that interrupt with their production. Okay, we have polyphenols and we have vitamin E and we have squalene, which is another compound we didn't talk about, but it's very important also. All these materials interrupt with this bad compounds. Evolution inside the oil, not evolution, I don't know, production
right.
inside the oil. In canola, soybean, sunflower oil, there's nothing to interrupt with this bad materials from emerging. Okay, so basically they are, and again, even in coconut oil, this is the same thing. Coconut oil gain
it's getting popular.
Popularity,
right.
Yeah, and it has
it's
now it's very
it.
Trendy.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not saying not baking with it. I'm not saying not I'm not using it. But if you want to be if you olive oil is the most healthier is the healthier oil, is the healthiest oil than all the oil.
But
if
even
you want
for
to use
baking
another one,
and frying,
use it.
So even for
everything.
Baking, everything.
Everything. I use mild olive oil for baking. Okay.
Okay.
I use olive oil in everything. I don't have any other oil in there.
Really?
In my,
wow.
In my kitchen.
So I'll ask you. Maybe it's not a fair question. It's like asking a father who his favorite child is. But do you have a favorite olive oil? Or it depends
actually,
what you're
no.
eating.
I depends on what I'm eating.
Uh-huh.
Depends on what I'm making. I love. They're all my sons.
Okay.
I like all of them. Every oil has its own characteristics. This is what so amazing about olive oil.
Right.
Okay. It's not just a flat oil that has no characteristics, no identity.
Character.
Okay.
Right.
Every oil has its own identity. This is what makes it so so amazing. And another thing is that around the Mediterranean and around where civilization started in the most sense, in the sense we know today, okay, like West civilization, around the Mediterranean, everybody used olive oil.
Right.
Everybody used, they didn't use any other oil.
Right.
Okay. My grandmother, when she came from Turkey to Israel, it was the first time she used another oil than olive oil.
Uh-huh.
In Turkey, she used only olive oil.
That was
it.
It was synonymous with olive oil. Huh.
Yeah, and it's the same thing with Tunisia, Libya, Algeria, I don't know, Spain,
right?
Greece, Jordan, Syria. Everybody used olive oil. Nobody used canola.
Right. Right.
Canola is a product of the last 30 years, and it's a very bad product. Don't use it.
So getting back to Israel olive oil for a minute. I know that we're a very small player when it comes to the olive oil that's produced in the Mediterranean. And I know I visited a farmer a few years ago when the Greek economy was collapsing, an Israeli who was growing olive trees up in the north, Kibbutz Eliyahu, and he said to me that there were certain Israeli olive growers who were pulling out their trees, which is like so painful to do that, to pull out a tree, because the Greeks were exporting olive oil. They needed to get money. They needed to get cash to the country any way they could. And they were exporting their olive oil at such cheap prices that people here couldn't compete. So olive oil is not an inexpensive commodity. In Israel here, do you think it's important that we continue to have our own olive trees, to have our own olive oil? Is it different in any way? Is it worth it to spend the extra money when there are, you know, cheaper brands that are out there? Like, as an Israeli, how do you feel here about the Israeli olive oil market?
So first, I think that in general, agriculture is very important for our lives. Mm-hmm. In so many aspects, so many aspects, in the way of keeping the soil from drifting, in the sense of green lungs,
right.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
In the sense of being dependent on your own economics instead of being dependent on others.
Right.
So there's a lot. There are a lot of morals that. Good morals that we have with agriculture, that mm-hmm. agriculture brings to our life. So it's very important to have agriculture in general. Olive trees are basically here much before us. So I think that it's something that we need to keep in mind. And they are, they've been helping us to survive in this area for so long. So,
we owe it to them.
Another, we owe to them. Yeah, we owe to them. Something.
No, but I agree with you.
But in this sense of when we talk about commodity oil from abroad, I think that it's not. Even if an olive oil comes from Spain, it's not necessarily bad. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And if it's better than an Israeli oil or an oil produced in Israel, a certain oil from a certain brand, okay,
right.
Take the oil you like more. It's not that the olive oil from Spain are no,
right.
Okay, or big no. Don't use olive oil out of Israel because it's not about that. It's about in Israel producers are asked to follow certain regulations, which oils that are coming from abroad, imported oils, are not. And this is the problem, okay? Because when we're talking about free economy and a capitalist economy that we all, I don't know, maybe some of us don't, but I think everybody appreciates.
Well, you grew up on a kibbutz, so I imagine now you're a great capitalist. Yes.
I evolved into a capitalism.
Exactly.
But I think that this is a free economy is important, but free economy with the same rules of playing.
Right. Comparing apples to apples, as it were, or olive oil to olive oil.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So we know what
now
we're getting here.
There's a new regulation, a new standard of olive oil in Israel. Just signed in last month, and this standard actually making us be able to compare apples to apples, because from last month olive oil that is imported to Israel has to follow the same regulation,
right.
The same standards Israeli oil needs to follow,
mm-hmm.
And in this sense from next year, if you are buying olive oil from Spain, you can be sure that it has to be in the same level as an Israeli oil. Now, this is much, much harder to make. Why? Not because Spain has bad olive oil. Not at all. Spain has some of the best olive oils in the world. Mm-hmm. But those olive oil, first, are really, really expensive, yeah. Much more expensive than Israeli oil. And the second, they're not for importing. Okay?
Right.
So the oil that's being imported outside Spain or Italy or Tunisia as a commodity is usually a low quality olive oil, mm-hmm. because the good olive oil is kept in the country.
So I mean, my personal feeling as an Israeli, if I want there to be Israeli agriculture, and I agree with you that it's very important for many reasons that we can provide our own food. So even if it costs a little bit more, I'm going to buy blue and white olive oil. We have to support our own farmers here. And I 100%. Don't think we're making any compromise, because the olive oil here just really is so wonderful. And we have to wrap up the interview, but I think especially on Hanukkah and talking about, you know, obviously the importance that it has. Until I moved to Israel, I did not realize how agricultural our religion was. You know, when you celebrate the holidays outside of the land of Israel, you don't realize that the holidays coincide with that harvest. And so we just finished the olive oil harvest, and here we are at Hanukkah.
Yeah, the olive oil season is ending with Hanukkah.
Exactly. Yeah, so, which also makes sense, because when, you know, the Maccabees did get the temple back and they needed to press the olive oil, if it had been June, they wouldn't have had any olives to press. And so coincidentally here in the month of Kislev, the end of the fall, beginning of the winter here in Israel, that's exactly when the olive harvest happens. And one interesting reason, incidentally, that I heard about why Hanukkah is 8 days is because they were priests. They were Kohanim who had just fought a war. So they weren't pure because blood had been spilled. And therefore, they had to wait 7 days in order to go into a mikveh to purify themselves. And on the 8th day, then they were able to go and press the olive oil and have fresh olive oil. And that's maybe one of the reasons why we have 8 days of Hanukkah, among the other reasons that are out there. So just to connect the agriculture and our history and our people and our holidays, which really, when you live here in Israel, you sense it. You sense the agricultural tie and to the land and to the people. And to go around Israel now, to be able to have a conversation with an olive oil expert now in the state of Israel, I think is marvelous, because not only are we back growing the olive oil, but now we have experts who can, you know, even tell other people in the world about different kinds of olive oils. And that is, I think, such an Israeli thing, that once we get back to what we're doing, we become the best, or among the best. So, Ehud, thank you so much for joining me and
thank you for
educating
me.
All of us, everything we ever wanted to know about olive oil.
Hanukkah Sameach.
Hanukkah Sameach to you as well. Take care. Thank you, everybody. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation. I hope you enjoyed that. Now you know what to do with your olive oil. Take care, everybody. Hanukkah Sameach. Have a happy Hanukkah. Goodbye. Thanks, Ben and Tabitha. Don't want to forget that. Okay, everybody. Goodbye for now.
Maus tzur Yeshuati.
Hanukkah light burns so bright.
Hanukkah, Hanukkah, come light the menorah.
Up in my lockers in the air sometimes.
Light one candle for the Maccabee children.
Hi, everybody. Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation. On behalf of myself and all of the hosts and wonderful staff behind the Land of Israel Network, I want to wish all of you a happy Hanukkah, a joyous festival of lights. And may we here at the Land of Israel Network continue to shine the light of Israel on the world. Thanks so much, everybody, for listening and supporting us.
Founded in 1902, World Mizrahi is a global, Torah-driven, community-focused educational organization committed to Jewish identity and destiny. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement.
Hey folks, this is Jeremy Gimpel. I want you to know, if you're a non-Jew from a Christian background or just a full-fledged Christian and you want to come to Israel, the best program, tour experience that you could possibly have is to go with Hayovel. Now, it's weird. I'm an Orthodox Jewish rabbi, and I'm telling Christians to go to this Christian ministry in the middle of Samaria. Let me tell you, there is no better experience for someone outside of the land, outside of the Jewish fold, to come into the land and work alongside the Jewish farmers of Samaria, to learn about the culture, to meet the people. It's an experience like no other, and I think it's also probably the cheapest way to travel to Israel. So go to hayovel.com.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is at Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments. Check out their website, www.windowsofjerusalem.com. They've got beautiful 1, 2, 3, 4-bedroom apartments in the best location in the city center with the most beautiful, breathtaking views. And I mean breathtaking. I've stayed there a number of times myself, and I'm telling you, there are few places anywhere in the city where you can take it all in to this degree. The view, the location, the great apartments, plus the wonderful staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com.